last couple of years, the average philanthropic funding in the nuclear space was around like $47 million a year. And again, these are kind of point estimates. And you should imagine uncertainty ranges around each of these. And then recently, the largest funder, the MacArthur Foundation, has withdrawn from the field, leaving kind of this shortfall that brings sort of the total expected amount of money to, say, $32 million a year. And so if you look at $32 million a year, that's basically nothing, right? The budget of Oppenheimer, the movie, was $100 million a year. So their filmmakers are spending three times as much on a movie about nuclear war as we're spending on sort of mitigating the risks from such a war.
Hi, listeners. This is 80K After Hours. I'm Luis Rodriguez, one of the hosts of the 80,000 Hours podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Founders Pledge researcher Christian Rule on a topic that's, well, I shouldn't say close to my heart, but I've certainly spent a lot of time thinking about it. Nuclear war. So before I joined 80,000 Hours, I was a researcher for Rethink Priorities, where my first ever kind of research work involved me trying to estimate how bad a nuclear war would be. And it's been a while since I've been fully immersed in that work, so I was super excited to talk to Christian about not only kind of how the risks have changed since I did my own research, but also on what he thinks are very underrated approaches to reducing the worst nuclear risks. So we talk through questions like, how can we ensure de-escalation can happen after the usual forms of interstate communication have been knocked out by nuclear war? What can we do to increase the odds that a democratic government will maintain control in a post-war civilization rather than an authoritarian one? And how can governments best prepare their citizens to survive nuclear-related devastation? Okay, without further ado, here's our conversation. Today I'm speaking with Christian Rule. Christian's a senior researcher at Founders Pledge, where he focuses on the worst risks from great power conflict and weapons of mass destruction, and where he also manages the Global Catastrophic Risks Fund. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Christian.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here. I should mention for our listeners that I have a stutter, so you'll hear some pauses and speech patterns throughout the conversation that might seem sort of unusual, but I think we'll get to that later.
Yeah. As a teaser, we actually are going to talk about that quite explicitly later on, about kind of your experience of having a stutter. And I'm personally really looking forward to talking about that with you and hearing what it's like. Before we do that, we're going to talk a bunch about nuclear war. And I guess, yeah, I'm excited to talk about what you call the kind of nuclear equivalent of mosquito nets in terms of nuclear interventions that might be kind of silver bullets, or at least very cost effective. But first, I'm curious to hear about your take on what some analysts are calling a new nuclear age. So basically, yeah, what is changing? What is making people say that we're in a new nuclear age?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So, so what are we talking about when we talk about the new nuclear age? I think what we're talking about at a really high level is the emergence of what people are calling this three-body problem in nuclear war with the U.S., Russia, and China now, at the same time that the world seems poised to undergo this revolution, basically, with AI.
Yeah, those do seem like very big things. Can you explain the three-body problem thing in, a bit more detail?
Yeah, so for much of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were the two nuclear superpowers. Other states eventually did acquire nuclear weapons, but in terms of arsenals, those two just tower over all of them. We're talking like orders of magnitude bigger. And that had been the case for a long time, this kind of bipolar order after Cold War. People in many cases kind of stopped paying attention to this altogether. And what's happened in the last couple of years is that China seems sort of poised to expand its own arsenal. So in like 2020, the number of warheads, the best estimates is sort of in the low 200s, 220 or so. Last year, that was up to 400 something. Now we're talking 500. And the sort of projections suggest it could be as high as 1,000 by 2030 and 1,500 by 2035. So really kind of like this massive increase.
Wow. Yeah. And I guess in thinking through the significance of this, I remember when I was learning about nuclear war and nuclear weapons years ago. Years ago makes it sound like it was like decades ago, a few years ago. I remember kind of concluding for myself that nuclear war between the US and Russia seemed like most terrifying because they had so many warheads between them that you could get this like terrible, scary thing called nuclear winter, which theoretically seems only likely to happen when you have thousands of nuclear warheads detonated. But so one thing that just sticks out to me immediately is like, there's another global power that might eventually potentially have enough warheads to create this kind of like catastrophic type outcome. Yeah, are there other things significant about this besides just like nuclear wars could be much worse? Well, at least the ones involving China now. For example, things about, I don't know, like the kind of game theoretic dynamics of how all of these countries relate to each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right, not all nuclear wars would be the same, and the very biggest wars would be by far the worst. So I think sort of what you've written in the past is exactly right on the issue. But yeah, so I think there's some structural changes too that happen. So negotiations just become more complex when you have three parties rather than two. And there are sort of issues with targeting when you're potentially facing two adversaries. I think it's helpful to kind of think about this with an analogy. So like, let's say you're an outlaw and a fellow outlaw has challenged you to a duel and you're outside and the tumbleweed is rolling and the vultures are flying overhead, right? It's a standoff. And we've been in that standoff for a while and suddenly a third person joins. And you don't know what to do. Are they going to point their gun at you? And that totally changes the structure of the game.
Totally. Yep. That makes it super visceral for me. Yeah, I would not like to be in that standoff. That sounds worse. I don't like it. Okay, so that's the three-body problem. And that does seem really important to me. I guess there's also the way AI might change things. So what's the kind of like high level overview of what that might look like?
Yeah, so I think it's really challenging to predict kind of the integration of AI in military systems. But we do see that states seem to be really interested in doing this. I think it all depends on how AI is developed and integrated, but sort of the features of the international system might very well pull states towards framing some of this as a race and as a competition. And so the kind of dynamics that we might worry about with transformative AI too, pushing states towards sort of premature deployment of unsafe technology. So that's the high level. And we have a report on this too, a Founders Pledge called Autonomous Weapons and Military AI. And I'm happy to kind of go into one example of what this might look like.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So I think a lot of people talk about kind of like integrating AI into NC3 systems themselves. That's like nuclear command, control, and communications. Fortunately, like a lot of states have said, like, we don't really want to do that.
That's great.
But I don't think you need that. It is, yeah. Of course, like, you know, that might change. But I don't think you need that to see how sort of AI-enabled warfare changes the risk of nuclear war. You can even just have AI integrated in conventional warfare, where let's say you automate more and more of the process, where AI-enabled weapon systems are just faster, right? You have AI-enabled chips, kind of support systems, and sort of many things start happening at machine speed and sort of shaving off some time here and there. And kind of the cumulative result of that might look like sort of speeding up the pace of war. And in China, they sometimes call this idea battlefield singularity. And in the West, it's sometimes called hyperwar.
Yeah, both the terms battlefield singularity and hyperwar sound terrifying to me. So don't love that. And just to make sure I understand, is the idea that, like, it's not that AI will necessarily be incorporated into nuclear weapons command and control and communications. It's that, like, war in general might become more automated and autonomous, using AI in a bunch of different ways. And then as that happened, just the pace of war could become so much faster in general that that would just be a scary thing, because as things escalated and leaders were considering nuclear weapons, everything would be moving at a more rapid pace and they'd have less time to make potentially nuclear related decisions. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's kind of a subset of the broader point that AI is this general purpose technology. So we might sort of expect it to transform a whole lot of how our world works. And this is a subset of that. So kind of to maybe make this more concrete, there's this article from Michael Horowitz called When Speed Kills. And so that gets at some of the intuitions. One of those could be that sort of with this increasing speed of war, you're compressing a two-week crisis into 2 hours, right? So imagine kind of the Cuban missile crisis playing out much, much faster. And that might not leave the time for people like Vasily Arkhipov, this Soviet naval officer who kind of famously helped prevent a nuclear torpedo launch during the crisis. When things happen so fast, there just might not be time for that. So maybe that helps make it more concrete.
Yeah, no, it does. Is it possible either or both of these things could actually make the world safer? Like, I don't know, maybe China having more nuclear weapons increases kind of a broader deterrence. Or maybe AI helps us avoid the kinds of mistakes that humans make and AI isn't totally immune to, but might make less than humans in the same way that, like, AI also kills people in, like, autonomous vehicle crashes, but it does so less than humans, and so it's still an improvement.
Yeah, I think both of those are totally possible, right? And we shouldn't be too alarmist about any of these. So, like, to, like, totally turn the example on its head, right, it's possible that if sort of the speed of war increases, that kind of leaves a longer window for making carefully considered decisions. Or it's possible sort of, yeah, having a third nuclear power makes you think twice about starting nuclear war. And, you know, ideally what we'd want is sort of a vibrant NGO community looking into all this, studying this rigorously. But as I think we'll get into, there's unfortunately not much funding for that at the moment. And that's, I think, the third factor that's making this time quite scary.
Yeah, actually, let's turn to that. I'm curious how, I don't know, ready we are for this new nuclear age. And maybe let's just start with what we have going for us. What's going well?
So I think we're not ready. But what's going well? I think one of the big things we have going for us is that apparently we've been very lucky. If you look at the history of the Cold War, the number of accidents, close calls, near misses, and so on, is horrifying. It's a miracle kind of that we haven't had a nuclear war yet. And I think this kind of provides a learning opportunity. It kind of teaches us we can't continue to rely on this good luck.
Yeah. Okay, so we've had luck on our side, but I guess you're worried that we won't indefinitely. But surely there are some things that are better now than they were in the last, I don't know, nuclear kind of eras.
Yeah, I think, like, the really big one that we should be thankful for is if we compare kind of the total world arsenals now to what we had sort of at the height of the Cold War, let's say 1986, right now, if you add it up, it comes out to just about 10,000. In 1986, we're talking 70,000 or thereabouts. So that's awesome. That's great, right? Like, we're much safer thanks to that. Another thing we have going for us is that the US, one of the biggest nuclear superpowers, has this kind of vibrant civil society and a fairly responsive government. And at least in this space, sort of good ideas and risk mitigation measures really can make it up to the highest levels. So I think there's a case for the tractability of policy advocacy here.
Cool. Okay. Yep. That is at least some good stuff. What is not going for us?
Yeah, so I think there's a really big one that we should talk about, which is this large funding shortfall recently. That means there are fewer people potentially working on these big emerging problems that we talked about earlier. So in the last couple of years, the average philanthropic funding in the nuclear space was around like $47 million a year. And again, these are kind of point estimates. You should imagine uncertainty ranges around each of these. And then recently, the largest funder, the MacArthur Foundation, has withdrawn from the field, leaving kind of this shortfall that brings sort of the total expected amount of money to, say, $32 million a year. And so if you look at $32 million a year, that's basically nothing, right? The budget of Oppenheimer, the movie, was $100 million a year. So their filmmakers are spending three times as much on a movie about nuclear war as we're spending on sort of mitigating the risks from such a war.
Yeah, that is really surprising and terrifying. And I feel like I'm relatively well informed about nuclear issues. And I still had no idea that the funding was that low. That feels really just alarming.
It's alarming, but also it's potentially an opportunity to kind of help guide the field towards some of the most important problems, right? At this point, kind of even fairly modest amounts of money, at least by the standards of philanthropists who spend, you know, billions pushing their preferred policies every year, a few million can actually sort of help us protect ourselves from the most extreme kinds of risks.
Yeah, okay. That's a nice reframe of a thing that is mostly, I think, pretty scary as an opportunity for people to use donations to do kind of more good than they might in a field that's less neglected right now. Okay, let's talk about potential interventions then. So my impression is that most of the work in the nuclear space is on nonproliferation and nuclear disarmament and deterrence. So mostly things that aim to reduce the odds that a nuclear war ever starts. But you're particularly interested in nuclear-related interventions that are helpful in scenarios where nuclear bombs have already been detonated. So you call these right of boom interventions. Can you explain the distinction between right of boom interventions and left of boom ones?
Yeah, so the big motivation here is sort of what is the high impact thing to do here. And I understand a high impact is a very unfortunate phrase to use when we're talking about bombs going off. But I'm going to make an analogy to car crashes. So for car crashes, we can maybe think about dividing interventions into left of crash and right of crash interventions, where left of crash includes things like rules of the road, stop signs, traffic lights, driver's licenses, and so on. And we also have right of crash interventions in case that the first layer of defense fails. So we're talking seat belts, airbags, features of a car just to make it safer, ambulances, hospitals. Why do we have this? Because we know that there are many reasons that cars crash and accidents happen. And so we can take that back to nuclear war. We really, really want to make sure that nuclear war never breaks out. But we also know from all of the examples of the Cold War, all of these close calls, that it very well could, as long as there are nuclear weapons in the world. So if it does, we want to have some kind of ways of preventing that from turning into a civilization-threatening cataclysm, the kind of war that sort of you've thought about in your own work. And those kinds of interventions, war limitation, intra-war escalation management, civil defense, those are kind of the seat belts and airbags of the nuclear world. So to kind of borrow a phrase from one of my colleagues, right of boom is sort of a class of interventions for when shit hits the fan. And before we go on, just to be clear, I think we shouldn't lose sight of that with nuclear war, we're really talking about kind of the mass murder of civilians on an almost unimaginable scale. So I'm talking about kind of in terms of limiting the damage to human civilization if a war does break out. The rest of this conversation, that's in no way meant to kind of legitimize the use or even possession of nuclear weapons or to encourage nuclear war fighting. Rather, it's kind of given the realities of this world, we're a fairly violent species of ape. We've built this civilization that somehow got its hands on these weapons. What can we do to minimize the horrible suffering that will occur if these weapons are ever used?
Yeah, totally. I remember when I was doing research on this topic, I'd catch myself saying things that were absolutely awful, like would only cause 500 million deaths.
Not... Right, it's a small nuclear war.
Yeah, right. When a small nuclear war is still truly one of the most horrific things I can imagine.
Exactly.
There are more horrific things, but that doesn't... that doesn't mean that a so-called small nuclear war or nuclear war that doesn't kill everyone is anything but too horrible for words. So yes, I appreciate that caveat. Are there other reasons that we should be dedicating more resources to right of boom interventions?
Yeah. So basically, the logic here is we should have a layered defense against catastrophic risks. There's this great article, I think from 2020, called Defense in Depth Against Human Extinction. Imagine you live in a world, again, with cars, but no seatbelts, no airbags, or any other safety features. That's the world we live in right now when it comes to nuclear war. And fundamentally, that's why I think we should be dedicating more resources to right of boom interventions. So that's a general idea. But it's also, as you kind of suggest, a subtler argument about philanthropic strategy here and about making allocations in philanthropy under high uncertainty. And so fundamentally, this is about taking not just one step back, but 10 steps back and thinking about the structure of the problem at a really high level to kind of figure out the most effective ways to do good at the margins. So we know a few things about nuclear war. First of all, not all nuclear wars are created equal. So there's a qualitative difference between a single weapon going off and the superpowers unleashing their full arsenals. So one of those is, as you said, there's truly horrific humanitarian disaster, but it's mostly local. And the other one is this unprecedented global cataclysm that might well threaten modern civilization itself. So Herman Kahn, the kind of Cold War strategist, has this phrase from his book on thermonuclear war, in which he sort of points to, quote, tragic but distinguishable post-war states. And so what he's saying there is the largest nuclear wars are disproportionately worse than smaller nuclear wars, which means that so much of the total expected cost there lies with those largest wars. It's a familiar feature in catastrophic risk. I think we see something very similar when looking at pandemics and biosecurity. That's a few reasons. One of those is kind of, as you pointed out, nuclear winter potentially kicking in. And now it turns out that these very interventions that, as you kind of just established, might be the most important ones from keeping a limited nuclear war from turning into the largest possible nuclear wars, also happen to be the interventions that are very neglected. And from a philanthropist's point of view, that's a sort of philanthropic jackpot. That's exactly what you want.
Right, right. Yeah, as a person who is hoping to direct philanthropist money is actually kind of music to your ears. You get to show people this awesome thing to do with their money.
That's right.
So let's talk about what some of those interventions are. There are quite a few of them, and I think they're really interesting, so I want to go through them one by one. The first one is de-escalating after accidental nuclear use. What exactly does that look like?
Yeah, so back to the car analogy. Let's say your car kind of suddenly breaks down on the highway. You can honk your horn, you can turn on your warning lights to signal to other drivers you had an accident, you can call somebody to help take care of your car. So in nuclear crises, that might help. That might sort of include that sort of leader-to-leader hotlines exist and that they're actually used as intended if, say, God forbid something goes wrong and a nuclear weapon accidentally goes off. So I have a report on this called Call Me Maybe that goes into this a bit more. But essentially, so the US and Russia have this long history of working together to reduce nuclear risks, and that includes the hotline that was established after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so if God forbid, something goes wrong, you can contact the other state and say, hey, sorry, please don't nuke us back. So this actually isn't a literal phone. It's sort of called the DCL, the Direct Communications Link. It used to be teletype via cable. Now it's basically like email via satellites. Okay, one big concrete problem here is that China is very bad at answering during crisis situations.
Wow, that's horrifying.
Yeah. So there's one example here where sort of Chinese leaders didn't respond to sort of repeated U.S. Contact attempts during the Hainan Island incident. It was in 2001. Yeah, so in this incident, sort of Chinese fighter jets got too close to a U.S. spy plane doing kind of routine operations, and the spy plane had to make an emergency landing on Hainan Island, and the U.S. plane kind of contained highly classified technology, and the crew sort of tried to destroy as much of it as possible as it could before being captured. If you kind of read through some of the reports, apparently they were pouring coffee on it at one point. So throughout the incident, sort of U.S. leaders tried to reach Chinese leaders via the hotline, but the Chinese didn't answer. So kind of the Deputy Secretary of State at the time remarked sort of, he says, it seems to be the case that when very, very difficult issues arise, it's sometimes hard to get the Chinese to answer the phone. And so this was 2001. Scary enough back then. I think sort of with heightened tensions now over Taiwan and over this South China Sea, we can imagine what might happen. So as a Biden administration official recently said, kind of, hotlines that have been set up have just rung kind of endlessly in empty rooms in China. So here we have kind of like a concrete problem, a concrete sort of funding opportunity that people actually haven't looked into much. Basically, fund a study to understand Chinese attitudes towards these systems, fund kind of track to diplomatic dialogues, see if we can find sort of common ground on, hey, maybe pick up the phone. And yeah.
How do we explain that? That's insane. Like, why, how is it not already in China's interest to use the phone explicitly for the purposes of emergencies? Maybe we just don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, I personally don't have a good answer. I mean, certainly, like, it's possible that someone might answer during what's perceived to be a real crisis, right?
Sure, so a if bigger an accidental, crisis or something.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that it might be sort of in the strategic interest of a country to kind of be ambiguous about sort of what it actually wants to do.
Yeah.
And so incidentally, it is also relevant, I think, for other kinds of accidents and catastrophic risks. So I think hotlines, when they work well, might be relevant. For example, for AI deployment accidents, communicating with other states about those kinds of risks.
Yeah, interesting. This just seems bizarre and surprising to me. It just feels like, obviously, countries that have the capability and may at some point have the interest in deploying nuclear weapons against one another should, like, obviously have the capacity to reach each other during an emergency. And those systems should obviously be, like, airtight. There should be, like, a main thing, a backup thing, like, a satellite thing, another type of thing. Like, this is just, like, it just seems very much in the interests of the kind of leadership of the countries we're talking about to have this. And so I'm just like, yeah, I'm just quite shocked that it isn't stronger.
Absolutely, yeah. So I've had kind of the same emotional reaction to this in a lot of ways. And so another example of it is track two engagement between the U.S. and China. So it's a sort of unofficial diplomatic talks. It turned out that there was just a single track two dialogue running between the U.S. and China that focused specifically on strategic nuclear issues. And like for the longest time until sort of some more recent developments, the U.S. and China just weren't talking at all about these issues. And this was sort of the only space in which that was happening. So we actually provided some funding to this dialogue to make sure it keeps going, but just like let that sink in, right? Like this huge risk and we're barely talking about it with each other.
Yeah, interesting. That sounds really worth funding. Okay, so another one of these right of boom interventions you think is promising is civil defense. What does that mean? What does it look like?
Right, so like think back to like March 2020 and like the confusion and fear that many of us felt about COVID, sort of not knowing how do I kind of keep myself and my family safe, right? So imagine instead of that, we had learned in school, hey, we know these outbreaks happen. So if something like this happens, here are some measures that can help. And imagine kind of the government had kind of taken steps to research pandemic-proof PPE, send kind of high-quality respirators to every household just in case, not that much money, and sort of protecting the civilian population in case of a war or in case of a different catastrophe. So if that's what we're talking about when we talk about civil defense. Today, it's often called emergency management. So like with nuclear war, we're talking about measures like shelters, evacuation, public education, what do you do, PPE again, stockpiles of critical supplies, food. It was always a topic that came up in the Cold War, but it never really got off. But it's mostly for political reasons, not because it wouldn't have worked.
Yep, that makes sense. It does seem like we did more of that in the Cold War. And yeah, I feel like there's this cultural meme of like duck and cover.
Right.
And it's kind of funny that we don't do that, even though it sounds like at least some of it would be reasonable to do. According to some people, we like face similarly scary nuclear threats today relative to the ones we were facing then. Arguably, that's not true, but it still seems like probably the risks are high enough that we should be doing something there if something there would work.
And we have some evidence that sort of some of these measures probably would work. In Nagasaki, there were about 400 people who, very close to ground zero, took shelter inside of these hillside caves. And these 400 people survived. And not only did they survive, except for the people who were sort of immediately by the entrances to the caves, they survived uninjured. So wow. Like, we know there are ways to protect people, right? This is really scary to think about, but like it's potentially worth thinking about.
Yeah, I actually didn't know that. So that's new and surprising to me. Moving to another one. We've already touched on this a little bit, but again, we have hotlines and also just specifically war termination. What do those look like?
So one of the things you want to be able to do, again, if a nuclear war breaks out, is make sure you have a way to communicate with the adversary to say, hey, let's stop this, let's find a way to have peace. And unfortunately, as far as I can tell from kind of public sources and from talking to experts about this, the nuclear hotlines we have seem likely to fail in the event of war. And obviously you can't end the war if you can't communicate with the adversary. And right, this hotline, you know, implemented, as I said, in 1963, like really early versions were pretty fragile and insecure. There was one kind of funny case where a farmer in Finland like accidentally plowed through a cable at 65. And then so they've made updates every once in a while. So they switched to satellite in 1971, added fax in 1984, and switched to email in 2008. But sort of one of the last public examinations we have about hotline resilience is from the 90s. And they write, quote, "The DCL is not designed to survive or function in a war environment. Its principal component subsystems are essentially unprotected against blast or other nuclear effects or electronic countermeasures, such as jamming." So again, like a huge problem, seems like obvious that we should try to fix it. I think like a study group in the public to say, you know, like we don't have access to the classified information about what these systems actually look like, but we want to make sure this will actually work.
I feel pretty shocked. I did not know that the hotlines would fail after a nuclear blast. That's insane. And when I imagine, like, it feels hard enough for leaders trying to de-escalate a nuclear war to do that with verbal communication and without, when you're just guessing about what another country is thinking, that just feels impossible. Absolutely horrifying.
Like, what are you gonna do? Like, explode bombs and like Morse code or something? I don't know, right?
That's bizarre. Yeah, truly bizarre. Do we just like have technology that would survive nuclear detonations, and like we could just in theory implement that, but haven't? Or do we have to develop something somehow that's more robust?
Yeah, so I think it's really complicated, and a lot of like the stuff about this, I do think is probably classified. So it's totally possible, right, that I'm wrong about a lot of this. But we know that nuclear weapon states care a lot about the communications links of their own systems. So the NC2, making sure that that keeps working. If a war breaks out, it's kind of this perennial focus of war planning, is sort of ensuring the resiliency of NC2 systems. And it would seem like kind of the very same care and sort of whatever measures are taken to, say, protect electronics from EMP, stuff like that, might very well be used kind of for state-to-state communications, or maybe you sort of make it redundant with multiple satellites in case there's like war in space, right? I think there are many things we can think of. Again, totally possible that I'm just like wrong about this, but from what we can tell publicly, like, it would fail.
Wow. Yeah. Crazy. Okay, so another one is mitigating nuclear winter, which is basically a thing that's hypothesized could happen if enough nuclear weapons were detonated in an area with a lot of flammable material. So if that happened, a lot of that kind of flammable material could get lofted up into the atmosphere, block out the sun, and cause massive global cooling. What kinds of interventions are you most excited about in the context of mitigating nuclear winter?
Yeah, great question, right? So I think the sort of extent and severity of cooling is kind of disputed, right? We've both talked about this. But like the basic mechanism of nuclear winter is, I think, sound. Most people agree on that, and sort of seems more likely to occur in larger nuclear wars. Remind me actually, so when you were looking at this, how many of the expected fatalities came from nuclear winter was the sort of direct effects of blast and fire, if you remember?
Yeah, I do. If I remember correctly, it was something like the direct effects kind of the nuclear bombs being detonated in places where humans live would be around 50 million. But the indirect effects of kind of a nuclear winter that affected big chunks of the world, I think might have caused something like 2 billion deaths at least.
Yeah, so this is huge, right? So if we like think kind of some of the estimates from the nuclear winter literature are too high, and we sort of cut that in half, it still makes up sort of like the vast majority of deaths in a large nuclear war. So it's really one of the things we might want to think about preventing. And strangely enough, it's sort of a thing that policymakers don't seem to think about very much at all. And what kind of interventions might that include? I think targeting policy is a big one. These things are classified, but as far as I'm aware, kind of the possibility of triggering nuclear winter through firestorms in cities is sort of not even a consideration that comes up. It really should be. So again, you can kind of fund high-quality studies to look at this, look at kind of realistic yields and targets, and show sort of these are the expected effects. If we change this a little bit, it might look different, sort of if we don't hit certain cities. Again, horrifying to contemplate, but again, like, might really save a lot of lives. Could also include advocacy around like food stockpiling, around sort of developing resilient foods. As you know, there are non prophets out there working on this, but this really should happen on a much larger scale. It really is a subset of civil defense.
Yep, I feel good about those getting more attention and more funding. If you're interested in how to feed everyone during a nuclear winter, Rob did a really, really excellent interview with David Denkenberger on the 80K podcast. And I think there maybe are two. And I think the first one was probably, yeah, my favorite 80K podcast of all time for several years. So highly recommend that. Okay, our final right of boom intervention is planning for a post-war political environment. That just alone sounds very scary to me. And I don't love thinking about it. But yeah, what should we be planning for?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that people don't appreciate is that even if nuclear war breaks out, and even if humanity survives, and even if civilization recovers, that recovery might not be with good values. So, you know, we can imagine things like unconstrained competition around AI between like multiple authoritarian states after a nuclear war over Taiwan. We might worry about the risk of locking in certain kinds of political systems and about totalitarian political systems perhaps being more likely to survive.
Sure. And just for context, the reason we might worry about this is because for various reasons, AI may make it possible to kind of lock in political systems or value systems by kind of stopping different modes of cultural evolution. For example, by enabling identical digital copies of totalitarian leaders so that there never has to be a regime change. Just for one example.
So let's think about like concrete levers we can actually maybe affect what kinds of political systems might survive after nuclear war. So like one of these in the US is the continuity of government plans or COG plans. So there's like Raven Rock designated survivor kind of stuff, making sure that sort of US government continues in some form, even if there's sort of a nuclear war. But if you look back and look at what some of the Cold War plans were for what to do, there's a great book called Raven Rock, actually, it talks about this. But let's take the Eisenhower administration as an example. As I understand it, the plans were sort of completely insane and like authoritarian. He had set up the system to, when in time of crisis, a small handful of his best friends who would take power, nationalize industries, restructure the government, and basically start this crazy oligarchy. Now, COG plans are obviously sort of very classified. That doesn't mean that philanthropists can't have an impact here. So one thing you could do is kind of fund a high-level study group, like continuity of government against emerging threats, include nuclear war, include biosecurity, include AI, and sort of do policy advocacy of key decision makers that ultimately make these plans and emphasize the importance of having mechanisms to return to constitutional democratic government, sort of to keep the kind of values that we care about. And there's actually an example of this in 2002, a right-leaning think tank AEI and a left-leaning think tank Brookings work together to do this continuity of government commission. So it's like precedent for doing something like this. Again, like I think there are really concrete things we can do to make sure that if, God forbid, something like this happens, things go a little bit better than they otherwise would.
Cool. That is really motivating. Very good to hear. So those are the interventions. Which one do you think is most promising?
Yeah, so one that I'm really excited about is just war limitation broadly defined, especially kind of policy advocacy around war planning execution that bears on the probability of nuclear winter. Yeah, so actually, like, Founders Pledge are putting our money where our mouths are, and we recently kind of made a grant, a three-year grant, $2.4 million, which, by the way, that puts us as, like, major funder in the field now, which is crazy, right? That shouldn't be the case.
Wild. But
this project called Averting Armageddon at Carnegie, led by James Acton and Ankit Panda. Basically, it asked a lot of these questions about war limitation, escalation management over 3 years. Think about, like, really in-depth, what can we do here? And they're asking, hey, what limits can we actually come up with? Which ones might stick? What are the technical obstacles? Things like hotlines failing, and sort of what can we do to make sure that these things go better?
Yeah, that does sound like a great grant to make. And just to reiterate that it is wild that you are now a major funder in the nuclear space with only $2.4 million.
Right.
So I guess, yeah, I guess that brings us to, yeah, this weird fact that very few institutions work on these kind of right of boom interventions.
Yeah, that's right. So in nuclear issues, we've heard this anecdotally that sort of right of boom interventions are only a small fraction of the total amount of work. We looked into this a little bit, tried to quantify it, and it looks like it's about like 3.3% or so of philanthropic funding, at least over the last 10 years or so. Again, it's kind of challenging to actually come up with an estimate because like the right of boom, left of boom distinction is a little bit fuzzy, but we searched through the funding database, really tried to find any grant that could plausibly be considered right of boom, came up with, you know, this rough 1 in 30 number, and then ran that by a bunch of nuclear experts, and they agreed, said, yep, literally nobody works on this. Most of them thought that estimate was probably too high. So James Acton from Carnegie told me, like, as a quote, 1 in 30 is an upper bound. I have to say, I'd be pretty surprised if it was as much as 1 in 30.
That's wild. Yeah, that's truly, truly wild. I guess I can imagine a few reasons for this, but before I make guesses, yeah, what do you think the most common ones are?
Yeah, great question. So I point you to a report called Philanthropy to the Right of Boom. It's also in the nuclear report. So like, yeah, why do we care that something is neglected? You know, many reasons, but two of them is that there might be low-hanging fruit to be found. Policy advocacy might be easier when a space is less crowded. But importantly, like neglectedness could also be an indicator that something is actually a bad idea. There's a reason people aren't doing it, right? So we need to look into the reasons that something is neglected. I think there are a couple of bad reasons. So this way of thinking has historically been associated with kind of hawkish Cold War thinking, and it's kind of still carries that ideological stain. So it's like a political PR ideological problem.
Sure. Makes sense. Yeah. Were there other reasons?
Yeah. So like you might have different worldviews or moral priorities. So if you think kind of the very existence of nuclear weapons itself is inherently immoral, there's something about the weapons themselves that makes them evil in a special way, right? You might actually not want to work on these kinds of interventions, right? Not everybody has the same worldview. If, on the other hand, you sort of think about the consequences of these things and sort of worry about saving human lives via those consequences, I think the perspective of right of boom makes a lot more sense. We interviewed a lot of experts about this and kind of asked, you know, and one thing that surprised me was sort of the answer was always like, oh, it just kind of has like bad vibes. Since the Cold War, we don't do this.
Wow.
And that's what it comes down to.
Huh. I guess somehow I actually do, I feel like I get it. Like, I don't believe it when I inspect it, but when I'm like imagining the US government investing in something like, I don't know, systems to make sure they can communicate with another country in the event of nuclear war, I'm like, how dare they plan for a nuclear right. war to happen? It feels very, it just feels kind of outrageous. It feels to me like upsetting and yucky, just really unpalatable that anyone's even thinking about this. So I do, yeah, I do kind of get it. But yeah, I would hope that the people thinking seriously about what to invest their resources in would like inspect that a bit closer. Yeah, are there any like good reasons not to fund these?
I think so. And just like hammer that home, like it does feel yucky, and like I personally feel that a lot when working with issues. It feels abhorrent to think about sort of using nuclear weapons, but at the same time, like when we think about it rationally, this is something that we do need to think about. Right, but good reasons that people might say, let's not pursue these kinds of interventions. One is that for various reasons, sort of decreasing the consequences of a nuclear war, you might think maybe that actually makes nuclear war more likely. So it makes it seem winnable, it makes it seem less abhorrent, sort of maybe undermines deterrence in one way or another. I lumped this all into one kind of category, so sort of decreasing consequences increases probabilities. So I kind of, to respond to that, I guess we can go back to the car analogy again, right? Like let's imagine we're in this town where for some reason they haven't had cars, and cars are new. And it's been a few weeks and we haven't had any car crashes. And so we've come up with like traffic lights, rules of the road, driver's licenses, so on. But we don't have seat belts, we don't have airbags, we don't have ambulances. And like, you know, maybe we want to suggest like, hey, we should think about these like bags that could inflate and somehow prevent the crash from being as bad. I don't really know what it looks like. Maybe we should like spend some money into a research project to see what it looks like. And then people might say, you know, oh, actually, what makes people safe drivers is that they're worried about crashing their cars. And then a couple of responses to that is like, maybe, but they're also like drunk drivers. And we know from history that sort of nuclear decision makers sometimes get drunk. There are malfunctions, there are accidents, all kinds of things can go wrong. So like, if we're thinking about mitigating nuclear winter and we're worried about like, oh, might this make nuclear war more probable? My simple answer to that is that decision makers generally don't even think about nuclear winter in the first place. And that means that if we're able to sort of decrease the probability of nuclear winter, that might not even enter into the decision-making calculus. And like, if you look at like the like historical examples of how decisions get made, what do they think about? They're not like, oh, you know, will 2 billion people die or will 1 billion people die? They say, one, this is horrifying. Many people could die. And we know that humans are scope insensitive from sort of various experiments. And they think about things like, oh, the upcoming like election, I wonder if I look weak if I don't do this, right? But, like, the sort of like rational calculation doesn't happen. And, you know, if you think about like who might die from a nuclear winter, I think like horrifyingly sort of already the like marginalized people, sort of people in the global south living in extreme poverty. And so do we think that enters the decision-making calculus of leaders in rich countries? Actually, here's a thing. We do have some evidence, right?
That's really dark.
Yeah, we have some evidence about sort of the behavior of leaders in sort of the political elite in rich countries. And it's generally that like they don't do anything about this sort of like global poor starving and dying. Miserable deaths happens every single day. And except for sort of small handful of people, we let the strategy happen right under our eyes. So the idea that that would change during nuclear war just doesn't make sense to me.
Right. Okay. So it's something like if I'm the political elite and I have, I don't know, if I'm like nearby to the decisions about starting a nuclear war, basically detonating nuclear weapons, and I'm thinking to myself, should I do this? That is not actually going to be that influenced by whether anyone has taken any measures to make sure that people in the global south don't starve to death during a nuclear winter.
Exactly.
That's just like not a key consideration for them. And on the one hand, that is incredibly sad and dark and depressing. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it means that this kind of risk is actually less worrying. Yeah, I think I basically at least buy that for some of these. I can imagine the argument being a little stronger for others. And so maybe there's like an interesting angle, which is like we prioritize especially highly interventions that seem especially unlikely to enter into the calculus of these decision makers.
And like what's happening here is we're making like empirical claims about the psychology of decision making, often without sort of empirical evidence. And, you know, I'll like make an offer here. I'd be willing to take a bet with anybody if we ran sort of an experimental war game about this. Decision makers would be sort of fairly insensitive to the numbers. You know, if somebody's worried about 200 million Americans dying, or 100 million Americans dying, I think in the brain of sort of most humans, that's just like the end of everything that I care about. And it's horrifying and sort of hard to even think about those numbers. And like at the risk of feeding a fed horse, I want to suggest that maybe like the opposite is true, right? That like threats might be more credible if they don't involve the total destruction of your own society.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Turning to a totally different topic. Yeah, you have very generously offered to talk about the experience of having a stutter. So I'm curious to just basically dive right into that if you're up for it. Starting, I guess, with what is the experience of stuttering like from the inside? What does it feel like to not be able to say what you want to say sometimes?
yeah, I guess now we get into kind of like the emotionally challenging territory. Now that we've talked about sort of hundreds of million people dying in nuclear war, right?
Right. Now for the hard stuff.
Right. Yeah. So like, I think some of my favorite episodes of ADK and of After Hours have been about like mental health and kind of, especially your kind of personal writing and speaking about the topic. And it's like, that's one of the reasons I was so excited to come on the podcast is to talk about a disability and a kind of like neurological disorder that you can actually hear on a podcast. And yeah. So what does this feel like? It's kind of like your thoughts are trapped inside of your body, right? So like, let's back up a little bit, like stuttering. What is it? It's like this neurological disorder. We don't really understand it, but it's now understood to probably have some sort of pretty strong genetic component, affects about 1% of the population. Most people grow out of it. And like from the outside, it often looks like people are sort of repeating, they're going, they're blocking, mm-hmm. sort of they're stopping in a specific thing, or they're prolonging their words, or prolonging, right? So I think from the outside, it sometimes looks like somebody is at a loss for words.
Right.
But in fact, what's happening is like, I have no trouble forming sentences, either in sort of like mental language, like concepts, images, whatever, or in English in my head. The issue is there's some sort of disconnect between what I want to say and sort of what my body is doing. It's not working right.
Right. Yeah, is it like, do you literally have the English word in your head, or is it more that you have the general ideas in your head, and then it's somewhere between ideas and words? Or is it more like you could literally hear the sentence in your head, and it's about speech?
Yeah, it's a really good question, right? I feel like we could go on a long tangent about this approach and about like the like language of thoughts. I think like mentalese is a word that people sometimes use, right? So like it's both, right? So I'm able to kind of form ideas and concepts in like mentalese in my head, and I'm able to kind of consciously like say them quote unquote out loud in my head, right? Fluently.
Right. Okay.
The issue is really translating that into vibrations of the air.
Got it. Okay, so that's what it feels like kind of intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
How has your stutter had much of an impact on you emotionally?
Yeah, I think 100%, right? I think it can be like really emotionally draining. I think I'm personally like fundamentally like an outgoing person, and it kind of like totally blocks that impulse. Yeah, so maybe we can think about like your average day, right? So, and think about like the moments every day that you rely on speaking fluently. So like maybe it's like the morning, it's like 7:30, you want to have a coffee, you go to your coffee shop, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna order a coffee. What kind of coffee should we order?
I would like a soy latte with vanilla and peppermint.
Okay, that's great. Or like soy latte with vanilla and peppermint, or as I might say, I'm gonna try to say it, right? And
yeah.
That's like what the person behind the counter might hear.
Uh-huh.
And kind of like totally block, stand there with an open mouth, looking helpless. And like, what does the other person see? Like, you think in your head, oh, what are they thinking? Do they think, is that guy having a stroke? Should I call an ambulance? Is he on drugs? Right. So like, maybe in the end you manage to get out the word, or you like point towards the board and just like, that was bad. But like you get the point across, like I want this specific thing. And, you know, then they ask, oh, what's the like name for the order? And like a frustrating thing that a lot of people who stutter have is that they block on their own name.
Oh my gosh.
So like, do I make up a fake name that's easier to say? Like, that's crazy. Or try to say my own name and can't? And then the response is like, oh, like, did you forget your name? Haha, right? This is like the morning.
That sounds so frustrating.
Let's imagine like you have your coffee, coffee in hand, walking out, and your hands are full of suddenly, like maybe remember something you wanted to write down for a report you're working on about nuclear war. Maybe you like try to use the like voice assistant on your phone, and like it's not designed to work for you. Right, but like that's kind of what it feels right? So like try to like paint a picture there. Small moments, like compared to like the things that are happening to many people, it's like not a big deal, but like all these small moments throughout your life that like where fluency would be really helpful.
Totally. Yeah. To what extent do you get desensitized to the feeling of like, oh, that was frustrating. I couldn't get the word out again. Or does that get limited at some point? And I don't know, maybe you feel a bit less frustrated, but it is just still freaking frustrating to not get the words out.
It remains really frustrating.
Oh,
yeah.
My
and it's
God.
Like, sort of getting desensitized to it is hard. It's kind of like, as I understand it, like the latest approach to speech therapy is kind of about this, right? Just like being okay with stuttering openly. But that's easier said than done. Or in my case, both hard to say and hard to do.
Yep. Yeah. Imagining it for myself, it is really, really hard to imagine. Yeah, just really hard to imagine just accepting this isn't going to get easier. It's going to keep happening. Yeah, I guess even more personal, do you feel like it had an impact on you growing up? I think maybe I'd imagine feeling especially awkward as a kid when I didn't understand the thing quite as well, and maybe other kids didn't understand the thing quite as well.
Yeah. So like, I was fortunate enough to like grow up in a really like loving home with great parents and so on. So that's wonderful. But like, you can imagine still like in school, right? The kid who can't say his own name or like who can't get a word out when called on in class is going to have a hard time. So I tried for a while doing speech therapy, and for some people that works. For me, it didn't. At one point, I don't remember if it was like at Cambridge or Oxford, but I'm a big fan of like self-experimentation. So I participated in this like experimental trial where they were like investigating transcranial direct current stimulation and trying to figure out if like zapping your brain a little can help. It didn't, but it was still interesting.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I guess I am curious to what extent you think it's, I'm both curious if you think the actual stutter has gotten better. And then I'm also curious if, your experience of it has gotten better. I'm like just super, super impressed that you're like, I'm going to go on a podcast. And I have to believe that, I don't know, it took a bunch of emotional work at least to get to the point where you were like, yep, I want to do that.
Thank you. Yeah. And I hope we didn't sort of give 30 minutes of content in 90 minutes of time. But so the stutter itself has not gotten better for me personally. Again, as I mentioned, I think a lot of kids grow out of it. I just didn't.
Yeah.
My emotional response to it, I think, has gotten better in the sense of like, at some point, you just have to like try being comfortable with being uncomfortable and like, okay, I managed this like philanthropic fund. It would be good for my people to know about it because I think it does a lot of like good in the world. And more people know about it, maybe they'll give money to it. So like, I should go on a podcast so people can hear about it. Ugh, I have to go on a podcast. So like, I'm trying to do that more. And like, in terms of stuttering less, there's this concept of like stuttering freely, of just like communication is a two-way street, right? And like, it's not just on the listener to speak fluently, it's also on the not just on the speaker to speak fluently, but also on the listener to like be patient. And I think we all have speech patterns of like ums and ahs.
Totally.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Okay. And then I mean, you're kind of touching on it already, but to what extent has having a stutter affected your career?
Yeah, like maybe I would do more podcasts. This is fun. but yeah, so like one part might be like job interviews, right? Like those can be really challenging. Actually, to go back, like other things that are in a similar boat are like talking to police or talking to like immigration services.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare.
It's the absolute worst, right? Because they think like you're hiding something and they get suspicious.
God.
And I already don't like them. And,
right. I'm terrified of talking to customs people.
Yeah. But anyway, back to like job interviews. Yeah. So those can be really frustrating and challenging. And I think like, I have to give like a bit of a shout out to like the Founders Pledge hiring process here, where they, I think like a lot of organizations working on these kinds of issues really emphasize like a work task. It was like do like expected value calculations on this difficult problem, so we're like write a short essay on this like philosophical issue. So it's like entirely about skills was like the meat of the hiring process. And I think that for somebody who has like a speech or hearing disability, sort of super helpful, right? And like once you do that, I feel like I find interviews being like, oh, by the way, I stutter, I have this thing, don't think it keeps me from doing good work. Yeah, I think back to how it affected your career, if I had to think about it, like maybe it's pushed me more into a career focused on writing as like an outlet for like the language part of my brain.
Yeah, that makes sense. Has it stopped you from applying to things? I don't know, just the fear of interviews or something.
In the past it has, yeah. Now I'm definitely trying to like catch myself and be like, nope, I should just apply, or like I should just be in this like panel.
Wow.
So like recently the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Hayden Belfield and I had written this article and they gave us a prize. They were like, good job on the article. And part of it was like speaking at the like annual meeting they have, the Conversations Before Midnight. And I was like, that's terrifying. But then I caught myself and I was like, hey, I should just do it. And I did. And I stuttered and it was like uncomfortable, but it was fine.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that sounds great. I guess my experience of repeatedly forcing myself to do things that sound really terrifying and costly is like, it is like in some cases it like gets easier over time. It's still really exhausting being like regularly, I am going to stifle my own fear about doing this, do this terrifying thing, like speak at a conference, and then have all the panic afterward about whether I did a good job. And like, even if it does get easier, it gets easier so slowly over time that it still means that like the first 30 times of speaking at a conference are like kind of torturous. I'm impressed that you have the like stamina. I feel like there are some things I've just given up on. Like I have like a default email that's like, I don't speak at conferences because it makes me too anxious. So I think it's really cool and inspiring that you, I don't know, push yourself. Do you feel like it's important to set limits? Like sometimes you give yourself an out to be like, I don't have to do that really hard thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm totally with you there. Don't have to be too hard on ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. And then how do you decide, I guess?
I mean, like one thing that's helpful with my job is like in terms of motivation, it helps that I feel like I'm genuinely doing good in the world. So like, let's say I'm like interviewing an expert about like pandemic preparedness. It's like much easier to kind of get over myself because I know that like, hey, maybe philanthropists can like help make grants to sort of mitigate these risks if I write a good report or whatever. So that's like one way of sort of deciding.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I guess overall, does it make your job harder?
Yeah, so I think like grant making and research done right ends up being a pretty social job. So like you're like talking to policymakers, going to like conferences, going to like war games, getting coffee with experts. And there's a great article from 2011 called The Elusive Craft of Evaluating Advocacy that gets into kind of the social part of a job like this. So like, for example, especially on Zoom, right? Talk to people, interview them about research questions. And they might say like, oh, I think we have a bad connection. And I'll say like, yeah, but the bad connection is in my head, unfortunately. I have a great anecdote about this actually. So like, I try to like advertise my stutter before I talk to people. I'm like, hey, just so you know, thanks so much for the interview. I have a stutter, so you might hear us on the call. And usually that's fine. At this point, like a person I talk to is like, okay, yeah, I'm so familiar with people who stutter. I actually have really bad PTSD, and it gets triggered by like plosive sounds. So people who block on certain letters,
wow,
like sometimes trigger my PTSD, right? This guy's like served in the military. Now he's like an expert on a specific topic. And he's like, so just so you're aware. And in my head, I'm like, ah, oh, shit. Like, I'm going to give this guy a flashback if I stutter.
Totally.
So that was like a specific part that really made my job harder and kind of like, yeah.
Oh, God.
Had really concentrate to be like, oh, yeah.
The vast majority of the time, this is just like actually not gonna harm anyone, giving them a heads up is a nice, great thing to do to clarify, but like, it's gonna be fine either way. And this is the one time where, I don't know if everyone knows what plosives are, but it's the like, it's like the hard consonant sounds you make. And it, that's really unlucky. Did that go okay in the end?
Yeah, it was fine. I think we were both fine in the end. So
nice. Yeah. Oof. Okay, well, I think we should leave that there for now, but I'm really, really grateful to you for sharing. And I guess people listening are going to value having heard you talk about that. So I guess a final question. I happen to know that you worked on an archaeological excavation in Guatemala. I'm curious in general what that was like. And I'm also curious if it had any influence on your interest in, the collapse of civilization and other kind of existential risks.
Totally, yeah. So, yeah, it ended up being kind of life-changing for me that it did spawn this like interest in civilizational collapse and ultimately in existential risks and the kind of things I work on now. Yeah, so like one summer, it's actually like 10 years ago now, I was living in Guatemala for a few months and we were working on excavating this Maya settlement. It was a satellite town of kind of the ancient city of Motul de San Jose in the north of the country. And just a note to listeners, I think you should be careful about like making claims about the like quote-unquote collapse of Maya civilization, because that's like a really complicated and multifaceted topic, right? The word collapse might not be right and it really depends on like specific settlements we're talking about. With that disclaimer out of the way, I'm just sort of describing my experience here and kind of like thinking about the idea of civilizational collapse. I remember distinctly at one point, like one of the layers I was like excavating was like this like beautiful white stucco, like perfectly level, better construction than you see sort of in most places today. And all of these artifacts of everyday life of the people who lived there. And yeah, it kind of struck me in like an emotional way that like many of the things and people and values that we love and hold dear today could be covered in rubble and dirt if we're not careful. And, you know, I'd like to avoid that fate for our civilization.
That's really heavy. With that, I think we should leave it there. My guest today has been Christian Rule. Thank you so much for coming on, Christian.
Thank you so much.
All right, ADK After Hours is produced and edited by Kieran Harris. The audio engineering team is led by Ben Cordell, with mastering and technical editing by Simon Mansour, Myla McGuire, and Dominic Armstrong. Additional content editing by myself and Katie Moore, who also puts together full transcripts and an extensive collection of links to learn more. Those are available on our site. Thanks for joining. Talk to you again soon.